Our ushers are going to come forward and give us an opportunity to continue to partner together as a community, to trust God and worship Him with our finances and partner together with what He's doing here locally, in us and through us, locally and around the globe. So if you came prepared to give and want to do so, this would be your time to do that. But seriously, though, what if all Rocky movies were like that? I mean, one punch and Stallone's like, ow! You know, I mean, what if they were all were like that? You know, there's something in us that sees that and thinks, you know what, that's just wrong. I mean, that's not what's supposed to happen. I mean, that's not what Rocky's all about. After all, I mean, some of us, we hear that song, you know, Eye of the Tiger comes on, and there's just something in us, or maybe it's just me, I don't know. But I used to, before big competitions, I used to love that song. I'd play it over and over again. I'd put on, you know, my big headphones, and I'd plug it in, and a little cassette tape, you know, Walkman thing, and I would just play that song over and over and over again to get pumped up, because there's something about us that just, yeah, you hear that, and you just get inspired. Because Rocky, he's one of those characters that comes to mind when we think of courage, when we think of being inspirational, when we think about taking on any challenge, no matter how big. Now, granted, some people, like my wife, you know, thinks she hates boxing, and the only word she'd call Rocky is stupid, you know, because boxing's just idiotic. But nevertheless, Rocky is supposed to be, I mean, it's supposed to be all about courage. It's about getting off the mat one more time after you're knocked down. I mean, it's a series of movies that have inspired a generation, except number five, which I really don't know what number five was about, but it wasn't inspirational at all. And so, but besides that, the reason so many of us are moved and inspired by Rocky movies is because deep down inside, we all want to live inspirational lives. We all want to live courageous lives. We all want to live lives that other people look at and just go, man, watching you and the way that you live, it just makes me want to live better in some way. After all, I mean, when you think about it, none of us, I guarantee none of us want to hear these kind of words shared at our funeral. None of us want to hear, well, you know, the one thing about Jonathan, if I'm going to remember Jonathan, the one thing about him was he played it safe his whole life. Always played it safe. You know, he never took a risk, never took a chance. He never faced any fears. You know, when I think about Jonathan, you know, whenever he was faced with a challenge, he always took the easy way out. Whenever things got hard, how could I take the easy way out? That was Jonathan. And none of us want to hear that. None of us want those kind of words spoken about our lives. And yet many of us, we go through life living that exact way. Living as if it was a life that we wanted was as with little risk as possible. Like that was the goal. And it ends up being, when we live that way, completely counter to the way that we actually want to live. The kind of lives that we're desperate to live, that we yearn for deep down in our soul. You see, I believe all of us, we want to live lives that are great. I mean, we want to live lives that are marked by a spirit of courage and perseverance. I talk to so many people who say, you know what, I just want to do something significant with my life. I just want my life to count. I want to live my life in such a way that it makes a difference in the world. I just don't want to stand around and watch life pass me by. I just don't want to stand around and watch other people live the kind of life that I wish that I could live. Be the kind of people that I wish I could be. Now listen, without trying to go Tony Robbins on us, you know, and charging $19.95 for my biblical 15 steps to success. Listen, each of us have the opportunity to live inspirational lives. Each of us have the opportunity to make a difference. Each of us, every day, have the opportunity to live courageously and boldly, to live the kind of lives that deep down we all want to live. And the excuses that many of us default to, we just have to realize that they don't work. Or some of us just say, well, you know what, I'm just not wired that way. I wasn't born that way. You know, some people are just born risk takers, and that's not me. Or we kind of default to excuses like, well, I just don't really have any that kind of special skill, or you need a special talent to really do that, or, you know, I don't have that kind of education. And so we come up with all these different excuses. Or better yet, in the church, many times we go through excuses like this. Sometimes we don't say them out loud. Sometimes we just think through them, and they're like, well, man, you know what? If God would just give me the opportunity, then I could do something. But why does God always pick her? I mean, why does God always pick him? I mean, God never picks me. And here the whole time I'm like, God, come on, I want you to do something huge with my life. God, I want you to do something significant with me and with who I am. And so come on, God, pick me. Man, I want to do something huge for you. I want to do something great. So we just end up blaming God for our lack of inactivity, for our lack of courage. We just find ourselves waiting around, watching other great lives pass us by, rather than embracing and taking action and choosing to do something with the opportunities that each of us have every day. If you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Luke in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Luke's the third book. Luke chapter 10. And we're going to start with verse 30. Now, this is one of the most famous stories in the scriptures. Even if you've had little or no exposure to church, this is a story that's most of us, I would imagine, know. It's a story that's inspired thousands and thousands of people throughout generations and across cultures. And it's a story that kind of sets itself up this way. Before we get into verse 30, there's an expert in the law, it says. Now, expert in the law is someone who knew the Old Testament. It was a religious teacher, someone who was very well skilled in understanding the Old Testament, had it memorized backwards and forwards, was kind of one of the religious elite. And it says this expert in the law comes to Jesus, and he walks up to him, and it says he wants to test him with a question. He's trying to trap Jesus in his words. The Jewish religious leaders at the time were constantly trying to figure out, how do we trap Jesus in what he's saying? How do we point out that Jesus is a hypocrite? How do we point out that he's saying one thing, but he's really a blasphemer against God? So how do we trap him in his words? So they're constantly trying to trap him. It says this expert comes to Jesus and says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What must I do to live life, the God kind of life?" That's what the question it was. Now, this was a very common question in this time and place, because people would ask this question and different Jewish rabbis and different Jewish teachers would respond in different ways based on how they interpreted the Old Testament. And many times the main differences were basically just semantics. It was all basically, you know, I might see it this way a little bit and see it this way a little bit. And so he's trying to catch Jesus in kind of this semantics kind of trap. So how do you exactly interpret it, Jesus? But see, Jesus is brilliant. I mean, we've been saying this all through the series. He's brilliant. And so he turns the question back around on him. He says, "Well, you know the law. Well, what's it written? What's written there in the law, in the Old Testament? How do you interpret it?" So, I mean, this guy, I mean, he's an expert in the law. The crowd's watching. Everybody's looking at him. I mean, he's supposed to know it backwards and forwards. And so he can't not answer the question. And so he responds, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And love your neighbor as yourself." So Jesus just simply says, "Sounds great. Yeah, you've answered well. You do that. You go and do that thing that you just said and you'll live." See, that wasn't enough. And so now this guy is like, "Oh, well, wait a second. I haven't got to trap him yet. I got to work a little bit harder." And it says, in order to justify himself, I love that verse 29. It says, to justify himself, he asked Jesus this question, "And who is my neighbor?" Now, see, the reason he wants to justify himself is because the religious elite, when they considered who they loved, it was those that were the religious elite. It was those who were the righteous ones, the ones who were doing supposedly all the right things, even if they were just putting on the false pretense for everyone else. It's they did the right motions. They did all the right check marks and got all those kinds of things in a row. And so Jesus is getting ready to answer him, but he wants to trap him. He wants to trap him because he knows Jesus is this guy who's been around. And he's supposed to be this Jewish teacher, this Jewish rabbi, and Jesus is hanging out with sinners. He's hanging out with the lepers, with the outcast, with the prostitutes, with the untouchables, with the people that the religious elite considered unworthy of God's presence, that these were people God was punishing because of their sickness and because of their situation. God was punishing them. You're not supposed to love them. You're not supposed to associate with them. They don't love God. And so they know this is how Jesus behaved. This is who Jesus is hanging out with. And so he tries to justify himself. "Well, this is who I love. I love the religious elite. That's what you're supposed to do. So Jesus, who's my neighbor then?" The way Jesus responds is Jesus decides to tell him a story. And he starts this way in verse 30. It says, in reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho." Now that was about a 17-mile trip. Just to kind of get that in your mind, it's about 17 miles. And the elevation, it's a pretty hard trip. The elevation dropped 3,300 feet from Jerusalem to Jericho. So a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. So here's this guy going on a journey, making this walk between Jerusalem and Jericho, and he gets beat. Half dead, lying there practically dead on the ground on the side of the road. Verse 31, it says, a priest happened to be going down the same road. Now this was a very common thing. Scholars estimate that somewhere around 10,000 priests and Levites, were kind of the assistants to the priests, these religious people who served in the temple, they would regularly make the journey between Jerusalem and Jericho because about 10,000 of them lived in Jericho and they would have to travel to Jerusalem where the temple was to do their ceremonial duties. And so this was a very common thing of priests and Levites traveling back and forth. It says a priest happened to be going down the same road. And when he saw the man, and I want you to notice that when he says he saw the man, because we're going to come back to that. He saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Now many times, you know, this story that we're all pretty familiar with, I mean, he gets kind of a bad rap, the priest and the Levite do. Because we think, you know, how evil can you be? I mean, and how awful can you be? But one of the things we need to understand is this guy had reasons. I mean, he had reasons in his own mind that he would stop, and reasons that we would consider, well, you know what, that's a fairly good reason. I mean, one of them was the priest as he's walking down. He's got to be thinking, you know, if I stop, these robbers might still be around, and they're going to come, and they're going to beat me half to death. And so, I mean, there's this natural fear of safety, this natural fear of his own life. I can't really stop to help because what about me? But probably more so than that, it's this very genuine fear that this was going to cost him significantly. You see, in the Jewish law, it said that if you touched a corpse, then you would be considered ceremonially unclean, and it would cost you. And then you would no longer be able to serve and carry out your priestly duties in the temple. And so this was going to cost him professionally. It could cost him financially if he took a risk, because this guy's laying there half dead. He doesn't know if he's alive or not. And if he gets close and he happens to touch him, this could cost him significantly. And so he just passes on by. Verse 32. So to a Levite, when he came to the place, again, here's an assistant to the priest, and saw him. There's that phrase again. He saw him. He saw the man. He saw the situation. He passed by on the other side. Now, again, this Levite, he's probably falling along behind the priest because he's kind of, you know, below him in the hierarchy and in the ranks. So he's falling behind. But he's like, well, the priest just walked him by. Obviously, he's not here. He didn't stop. So he must have had good reasons. So I just better keep on walking. The same rules applied to him, the same Jewish laws. Well, if I do stop, then I might be considered ceremonially unclean, and then I won't be able to perform my duties in the temple for a period of time. It might even cost me being able to progress up kind of the hierarchical ladder to be able to become a priest someday and to get to that point. There's huge costs that are involved here, and so he just passes on by. Look at verse 33. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. Now you got to understand that when the Jewish people heard the idea of Samaritan, they would have probably been like, oh. I mean, Samaritans were considered detestable. A Samaritan by the Jewish people were considered these kind of half-breeds, and there's all sorts of explanation that gets into why there was such hostility between the two groups. But I mean, they hated the Samaritans. They considered them, you know, people that you did not associate with. So this idea of a Samaritan as he traveled came where the man was, and when he saw him, there's that phrase again, when he saw him, he took pity on him. Translates there to that his heart went out to him. He had compassion on him. Verse 34, so he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said. And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Now, one of the things that we have to understand is that the Samaritan had just as many reasons, if not more reasons, of why he shouldn't stop. He saw the same thing that the priest and the Levite did, but had more reasons not to stop. I mean, after all, if he stops, yeah, his life is in danger. And if people saw a Samaritan along this road and Jewish people saw him, they were more likely than to kill him, not just leave him maybe half dead, but to definitely kill him. There was intense hatred. But he has all these other reasons that he keeps facing, because as he goes down through the list, all of a sudden, then he pours oil and wine on him. That was expensive. That was going to cost him financially. He's got to put this guy on his donkey. Now, this guy was going somewhere. So he had a schedule. He had things to do, places to go, people to see. He was on a mission. He was going somewhere. And yet, all of a sudden, that has to get interrupted. All of a sudden, his schedule is going to get affected. And not only that, he's going to have to be traveling down this road, carrying this guy on his donkey, treating him kind of like royalty, pulling this donkey along with this guy riding on his donkey. He would look like this guy's servant. And so it's going to cost him shame. It's going to cost him how people might look at him. So he goes to the innkeeper and he spends the night. So his plans might have had to get altered. And he stays the night to take care of this guy. There's blood that it says that it has to bandage him and wound him. And there's all sorts of fears and everything about touching somebody that's wounded. We get that today. You see blood everywhere. Everybody's kind of like, I don't know if I should touch it because I might catch this or I might get that. And so there's all these fears built in. He had more than enough reasons to walk on by. And yet he didn't. Verse 36, Jesus finishes the story and he says, so, which of these then, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Verse 37, the expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. You can imagine that he probably mumbled it, you know? And if you notice, he doesn't even say the word Samaritan. Won't even come out of his mouth. Just simply, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus says, go and do likewise. Now, there's all sorts of different directions that we could go with this story. But what I want to do is I just want to drill down for the next few minutes on this simple reality that three people saw the same situation. They saw the same situation. That word appears three times in the story, that they all saw, that they all noticed the same circumstances. They all noticed the same person needing help. And yet the first two justified in their own mind why they shouldn't get involved. Now understand, it wasn't because they were bad people. It wasn't because they were evil people or had evil intent. People that we can just dismiss. They were people that in their own mind had very good reasons and justifications for not stopping. But the same thing happens to us so many times, doesn't it? I mean, we see something that needs to be done, or we see something that should be done. We see a situation where somebody needs to step up and do something. But whatever the situation is, it doesn't have to be somebody on the side of the road half dead. But whenever we face kind of a situation where we see something that should be done or needs to be done, we start doing these sorts of mental gymnastics. We can start coming up with all sorts of justifications in our own mind to essentially talk ourselves out of helping. All sorts of reasons why we shouldn't get involved. All sorts of reasons why we shouldn't give money, why we shouldn't be the ones to go. All sorts of different reasons we begin to talk ourselves out of doing something because I've got all sorts of reasons why I shouldn't be the one to speak up. All sorts of reasons and justifications why I shouldn't be the one to step in. And we can get very good at convincing ourselves in the moment that it's the right thing. Get very good at convincing ourselves it's the best thing for us to do. But the Samaritan in the story, again, who had just as many reasons and just as many justifications, if not more, for not getting involved, he saw the man and chose to do something. He chose to act. You see, many of us, we can default to this idea or notion that the most spiritual thing we can do in a situation is pray. And sometimes we'll be driving down the road and we'll see somebody and, you know, we just beat ourselves up sometimes even when we forget to pray because there's an accident and, you know, we think, well, we should stop, but we don't. But then we're just going on by and then, you know, a few miles down the road, what goes through our mind is, man, I can't believe I didn't even pray for the person. And we just beat ourselves up over that. We were only thinking about maybe ourselves and maybe how it might inconvenience us. But you see, the reality is, the most spiritual thing we can do most of the time is it's not prayer, but it's that we choose to act. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, prayer is good and prayer is important. Prayer is necessary. But prayer too often is used as an excuse not to act. Prayer is used as an excuse not to choose to do something. It's an excuse for our inactivity. The most spiritual thing that we can do many times is simply choose to act. Now, with that in mind, one of the critical things that we have to understand about ourselves, We have to kind of understand this battle that goes on within us. And we have to realize that the more responsibility we have, the more authority we have, the more responsibility we have, typically the less inclined we will be to act courageously. Because you see, there's way too many factors for us to think through and to think through, well, if I take a risk and if I do this, if I act courageously here, then it could affect this person and this person and this person and this layer of the organization, this layer of the organization. There's so many different people it'll affect. And so, because our natural inclinations are going to be to say, no, just play it safe. But at some point, each of us has to choose to say, you know what? I'm not going to let my busyness, I'm not going to let my responsibilities, I'm not going to let my wealth, I'm not going to let my fears, I'm not going to let my insecurities, whatever it is, keep me from seeing something that needs to be done and being the one who chooses to do something about it. I'm not going to let all that keep me from living the life that I desperately want to live. And so with the rest of our time this morning, I just want to deal with and I want to address some of the justifications and mental gymnastics that tend to bounce around inside all of our heads and that have the potential to hinder us from acting on the opportunities that come before us each and every day to live inspirational and courageous lives, to live the kind of lives that we all deep down inside want to live. And so if you have a pen or a pencil or some paper, you might want to jot some of these down, because the first one is simply this. It's that we have to learn to refuse to be paralyzed by the fear of the worst case scenario. We have to refuse to be paralyzed by the fear of the worst case scenario. If you still have your Bibles open, flip back to the book of Proverbs, chapter 26. Proverbs is kind of right in the middle of your Bible, right after the book of Psalms. Proverbs chapter 26. If not, we'll put the words on the screen behind me. But this is the verse actually that kind of catalyzed this whole teaching for me. Probably a couple years ago, came across this and I've been tossing it around, wrestling through it, trying to live out some of the implications in my own life. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 13, it says this. It says, "The sluggard says, there is a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets." Now, one of the things with Proverbs is there's all these, you know, kind of wisdom sayings all throughout the book. And so not many, some of them build upon one another, but some of them are just kind of these short wisdom sayings, and you have to kind of get into the context to understand what's going on. But this idea of a sluggard here, when you picture about what that is, it's what many of us would think that it is. It's someone who's lazy, someone that doesn't have any motivation to do anything. But something I noticed this week as I was studying this word that I've never noticed before, that in the scriptures in the Hebrew, this word sluggard also has in it this meaning of a moral failure. A moral failure is the exact phrase that it used, moral failure, when defining it in Hebrew. Now, you see, when we tend to think of a moral failure, we tend to think of someone who does something that they know that they shouldn't. That a moral failure is doing something wrong. But in the scriptures, though, here, this core idea of a moral failure is someone who doesn't do what they should do. It's someone who doesn't choose to act. That's what the scriptures here have this connotation of a moral failure, where sometimes they get so focused on not doing the wrong things that what ends up happening is that they fail to do anything right. They fail to do anything good. They fail to do the things that they should do because they're so focused on not trying to screw anything up. So focused on not trying to do anything wrong. And so it says here, the sluggard. The sluggard says, you know, I'm not getting up. I'm not going out there. And it goes to this extreme excuse. Well, you know, this totally unlikely scenario. Well, there's just a lion out in the road. I'm not getting out of my house. There's a lion out in the streets. There's this fierce lion roaming out there. And if I go outside, if I actually try to do something, get off my couch and actually do something, I mean, it's just going to devour me and my life's over. So I'm just going to just let it be. It would be the equivalent of us sitting in our house and saying, you know what, I'm not going outside because if I go outside, I know I'm just going to get struck by lightning. So I might as well just sit here, you know, on my lazy boy and just keep watching TV all day long because, you know, I just get struck by lightning if I go outside. Now, this whole series of teachings that we've been in the last several weeks, it's really centered around wisdom. But you see, when it comes to decisions, many times what happens is we don't exercise wisdom. Wisdom gets thrown out the window. When it's all said and done, many times what happens is fear overrides wisdom. So I want to play that out for you and see how that happens. So let's just imagine here, kind of on a scale of 1 to 10. That we've got one being the worst case scenario. Well, that's probably so small nobody can see that. All right, here we go. Worst case. That's a little better. This is a 1, all right? 10, let's just consider 10 as, you know, life change, life transformation, permanent. It's this great thing that will happen to us, great joy, great peace, just transformation in our life. Many times what happens is we end up living these lives that live in complete fear of this and that keep us from ever experiencing this. And so most of us live very safe lives. And so we kind of live in this realm of like a 3 or a 4. You know, this is kind of where we end up living because it's safe. So we don't live in the worst case scenario. This isn't our reality, but we just live in fear of that reality. And so we end up living here because we're scared of this. Even if wisdom, it doesn't make any sense of that worst case scenario. Even if the odds here are like 1 in a million, 1 in a trillion that this would ever happen. It's the fear of this that keeps us here and prevents us from ever experiencing this. That if we would make one decision, if we would do one thing, the potential for this happening is great, extremely likely. But see, this plays itself out all the way in simple ways in our life, all the way up to very complex ways. Just think back to maybe some of you when you were in high school. Fellows, we'll just kind of pick on us for a minute. Maybe remember, you know, maybe you're a freshman. It's kind of the freshman dance, you know, at high school. And you see this girl across the room and you'd like to ask her to dance. You know, maybe you're just at a party, you know, and so you're like, man, I'd really like to ask that girl to dance. But you're like, what if she says no? But see, and so we get scared. We're like, well, I can't ask because it says no. But see, it's not just the rejection of that no that keeps us from asking. What happens is we start playing out this worst case scenario. Because it's not the no that really scares us. We start to say, you know, man, if I ask her, she's not only going to say no, I bet she's going to laugh at my face. You know, and not only is she going to laugh at my face, she's going to look at me and be like, hey, everybody, look at this nerd. He just asked me to dance. And then we start playing it out in our mind. And then everybody in the whole party, you know, and everybody's going to start looking at me and they're all going to start laughing. And then they're all start going, nerd, 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 you know. And then I'm going to walk into school the next day and everybody's going to look at me. And I'm going to walk down the halls, nerd, nerd, nerd. And I'm going to be the dork. I'm going to be the nerd that tried to ask the girl that was way out of my league to dance. And there's just no way that could ever happen. And so I'm just going to sit here kind of along the side of the wall and just sit, you know. It's not just the no. I mean, we play out this worst case scenario, this thing that likely would never happen, but it prevents us from even trying, from even taking a shot at asking, even though she may say yes. There's a likelihood that she may say yes. There's a likelihood that you end up getting married and having kids and the white picket fence and the beautiful kids and you're just like, wow, you know, all that could happen. We never even take a step toward that because we're paralyzed by this. But yeah, and it's just not in simple ways. It gets bigger, you know, as kind of our life goes on and we start thinking about, well, somebody that hurt me, you know, and I know I should forgive them, but man, that's a choice that I just don't know if I'm willing to make because if I choose to actually forgive them, you know, well, then maybe they're going to get away with it. And if they get away with it, maybe then they're going to think that what they did was right and was justified. And if I forgive them, then they're never going to get held accountable for what they did. And God's not going to remember what they did. And so then they're just going to go on, keep doing the same thing they did over and over and over again and hurting all these other people. And so, you know what? There's just no way I forgive them. It's my responsibility to make sure that they remember what they did. And so we hold on to this absolute worst case scenario, this fear of it. And so it keeps us from ever forgiving, knowing that if we could forgive them, man, a great amount of peace could come to our lives because there's this bitterness that rests inside of you right now that everything gets filtered through. Every hurt and every pain and every experience in your life, it gets filtered through that bitterness and you could be free from that baggage and free from that pain and free from that hurt that just everything gets filtered through. But there's a forgiveness that needs to happen, but we're just too scared to. And so we just kind of live here and say, you know, I'm bitter and yeah, but I'm just going to have to live with that. And yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a negative person because of it, but I'm just going to live with that. I'm going to live here in 3 or 4 because it's safe. We do it with money all the time. You know, we think about giving generously to somebody else. You know, here's someone in need. Here's a situation. Here's a person. I see someone who has a need, or here's a cause, or here's an organization, or here's a mission that, you know, I could give generously to. But you know what, man, what if they just take advantage of me? We start playing that out. You know, what if they abuse my money? What if they don't spend it in the way that they think they're going to spend it? Or better yet, you know what? If I give money, then I'm going to be broke. What about me? I'm not going to have any money 30 years from now. If I give some money now and if I'm really generous now, then what about 30 years from now? What if I'm eating Spam out of a can for the rest of my life, you know, and I've got no retirement fund, no 401k. Everything's going to completely fall apart. So I can't give to them right now. It's better just to kind of keep it to myself. And yet the amazing thing is we keep hearing stories of people over and over again who give generously. And they talk about how fulfilled that they are. We talk about the joy that it brings them, the transformation that happens in their lives, the fulfillment that they have. And not only it affects their own lives, but the people that they give to and how it transforms their lives and that we can be a part of that. And yet fear of the worst case scenario just keeps us here. I'll just kind of just give a little bit here and there, just enough to kind of, I'll just give a little bit. I don't need to give generously. I don't need to give extravagantly because, I mean, what if all this happened? Hear that on about mission trips where people will say, you know what, I can't go on a mission trip, you know, because you know what, I know what will happen. If I go on that mission trip, I'm going to get on that plane and it's going to crash, you know, we're going to die, and I'm going to come out as soon as I step down in that third world country, savages are going to come out of the woods and they're going to kill me, and that's just what's going to happen. I know that in my head, so I can't do that. So we live in this fear of the worst case scenario, and see, the thing is, we don't even think through the wisdom of it. That's one of the big problems. We don't think through the wisdom of it. That right now, I mean, I checked the National Safety Council here in America, statistics-wise. All right? The chances that one of us would die in a plane crash in America this year are 1 in 400,000. Those are the odds. Now, the odds that we would die in a car accident sometime this year, 1 in 6,500. But most of us, we don't have any problem getting in our car. The odds that we would die walking across the street, 1 in 48,500. Just walking across the street. I mean, the odds are so much less. And so we think, oh, I'm being so wise by staying home. And what happens is fear trumps wisdom. Fear just knocks wisdom out the door. And so all of a sudden, this incredible life transformation that could happen in us by saying, man, I'm going to go and get exposed to things I've never seen before and be a part of loving people in a way that could transform their lives and transform my life. We let fear of this worst case scenario just say, no, I'll just kind of rest here where it's kind of easy and it's safe. And so we have this opportunity to forgive, and we say, no, there's this lion in the streets. There's no way I can do that. We have this opportunity to give, and we say, no, I can't give. There's a lion in the streets. We have an opportunity to go and to go into among the homeless, or to go in the inner city, or to go on a mission trip, and we say, no, there's a lion in the streets. There's no way I can do that. And what ends up happening is we refuse to live life the way it's meant to be, and we end up being paralyzed by this fear of the worst case scenario. Second thing I want to suggest to you is that to navigate through all the chaos in our mind is to simply quit waiting for an invitation. Is that we need to quit waiting for an invitation. What I mean by that is I think a lot of followers of Jesus think that God is all about telling us no. That God is all about telling us don't do that, don't do this. And we get so scared of doing something wrong. We get so scared of messing up God's plan for our lives. And so we end up sitting around waiting for some yes to magically appear in the sky from God that prompts us to actually do something. We keep waiting around for some type of sign, some type of invitation from God. I love the next verse there in Proverbs where it says in verse 14 of chapter 26, it says, as a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed. That's a convicting picture. And again, I understand this isn't about being busy, because lots of us could say, there's no way I'm a sluggard. There's no way I'm lazy. I stay busy all the time. But see, the issue is a lot of us can stay very busy in all the safe details of our lives. But we can still be just like a door turning on its hinges, like a sluggard rolling over on his bed from side to side, choosing not to act on anything that requires any significant risk in our lives. You know, I think way more often than not, God isn't saying no nearly as much as God is saying, go. Go. See, understand, God has already given us an invitation. God has already given us a mission. God has said, go into all the world. Show people what it means to trust me and to follow me. Show people what it means to live life the best it can possibly be. Love people. You be committed to other people's best interest, regardless of who they are, regardless of what they believe, what country they're from, regardless of what sickness they have or what sins that they struggle with. You go and you give and you serve and you offer hope. And you go. You go. Don't wait around for an invitation. Your invitation has already been given. But then as we go out, we have to recognize that just because it may be hard, just because it may be difficult, it doesn't mean that God is against it. doesn't mean that God's against it. I mean, many times we default to this thinking, well, it's got to be, if it's not easy, then it doesn't equal, then it can't be God's will. Because if it's God's will, it has to be easy. God doesn't, of course God doesn't want us to be doing that because it's hard. It's difficult. Maybe this wasn't what God wanted us to do because now we actually have less money than we did before. It hasn't turned out like we thought it did. You know, I didn't get the job that I wanted. I didn't get the promotion. I didn't, you know, get the white picket fence. Wait a second. Maybe we just got it all completely wrong and we assume that if it's God's will, it's supposed to be easy. But we all need to be reminded that's not what we see in the scriptures. It's not what we see in the lives of the followers of Jesus. Paul, who wrote half the New Testament that we have in the Bible, this follower of Jesus, when we look at his life, we constantly find him shipwrecked and beaten and stoned and jailed and whipped and poor and ill. And yet the scriptures keep telling us that the Holy Spirit is communicating to Paul, you are right in the center of God's will for you. You're trusting me, you're following me. And Paul's life has inspired millions of people, but he understood that choosing to live, choosing to act courageously also came with great challenges, often came with great hardship, often came still with fear. Because you see, we're all smart enough to know and smart enough to remember, but we have to be reminded sometimes that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage assumes fear. Courage presses forward in the midst of it. It decides. It chooses to act. Now the last thing is that we have to be careful to not constantly go to this excuse of, well, you know what, I just don't know enough yet. I just don't know enough yet. You know, all the information isn't in, and so I can't move. I can't decide. Now, this isn't saying, hear me on this, this isn't saying that you don't exercise wisdom. This isn't saying that you don't seek counsel. This isn't saying that you don't research decisions and options. But the reality is many of us become paralyzed from taking action because we continually and constantly excuse it with thoughts like, well, I just don't have all the details in yet. You know, I haven't been able to think through all the different possible scenarios of how it might turn out. Jim Collins is an author and a business leader, and he says, great leaders learn to make decisions on less information. And that if you wait for all the information to come in, that's what you're doing. If you're always waiting for all the information to come in, you will stay paralyzed. It will keep you from moving forward because you'll never have all the information that you want. So you have to learn to choose to act, to move courageously, to move boldly. The reality is, for some of you, that's been the hang-up that you've had with Jesus. We kind of wrapped up this whole series, you know, about wisdom, and it all centers around Jesus. Jesus in himself personifies wisdom. And some of you, you haven't chosen to surrender to him or to trust him. You're okay with a little bit of Jesus, but not a whole lot of Jesus. Not like I want to surrender to you and trust you with my life. And you kind of fall back to this, well, I just don't have answers to all my questions yet. And listen, that's not to make light of legitimate questions. This is the kind of community that we welcome questions. We encourage questions. We want you to pursue your questions, openly doubt, and run after God. But some of you, though, you just keep coming up with more and more questions. And you use it as an excuse. Say, well, you know what? I just don't have the answer to that yet, so I'm not going to. And some of you, for a long time, you've just wanted to stay in this realm of just being okay with a little bit of Jesus. Because what happens is you start to go through this intellectual worst-case scenario. Well, what would my family think? And what would my coworkers think if I actually surrender to Jesus and start following him and call myself a Christian? What would they think? What, are they going to label me as some kind of Jesus freak if I actually start giving and loving on people that aren't like me and doing these kind of things? Are they just going to label me this freak? So it's this intellectual worst case scenario, and we say there's this lion out in the streets. There's this thing that I don't want to get labeled as. So we have all this fear, and so we're just like, you know what, I'll just kind of stay safe. I'll kind of stay at a 3 or a 4. I'll say, you know, I'll go to church. I'll show up on Sundays. I'll sit in the chair. I'll listen to teaching. I'll go, you know, I'll say a prayer before meals. Let's just kind of keep it safe. And yet there's this life that's calling us, that Jesus is inviting us into, a life that requires us to surrender and to trust him and to say, you know what, I want to live this absolute best life possible. I want to be transformed. For some of you, you need to make that step. And you need to say, okay, you know, I'm not going to let this fear of the worst case scenario hinder me any longer. Man, I'm going to go for it. I don't have all my answers in, but man, I'm going to I'm going to go for it. There comes a point you just have to jump and you have to decide, and let's go for it. I want to live life. I don't want to make the goal at the end of my life just to arrive safely at my deathbed. I want to live. I want to go for it. Friends, I want you to know that's the kind of community that I want us to be. I want that for you individually, and I want that for your families, but I want it for us as a church. That we would be that kind of church where it's so tempting so many times, I know for me as the leader, to look at all these things and to be paralyzed by, well, what if this happens, and, you know, what if we do this and then everyone just leaves, or what if we do this and then no one decides to give anymore, and what if we do, and just to be paralyzed by all these fears rather than just saying, you know, God, who do you want us to be? Where do you want us to go? What do you want us to do? All right, God, we're going to go. We're going to go. And I want to be that kind of leader, and I want us to be that kind of church that lives the life that Jesus is inviting us into, and that as people look at us, that they'll say, that's what it means to trust and follow Jesus, and it will be so attractive and so appealing that God will use us as a community and what we're doing to continually draw people from all over to Himself. Let me pray for us. Father, would you grant us courage to not be paralyzed by the fear of the worst case scenario? Father, may we not live lives that constantly find ourselves saying, there's a lion out in the streets. I can't give, I can't forgive, I can't move, I can't go, I can't do that because there's this lion out in the streets. God, may we not live lives with fear. May we live lives that demonstrate that we trust your goodness, that we trust who we are, we trust your sovereignty, we trust that you know far more than we do, and that we trust that you are always leading us into life, and that you are weaving this grand story throughout the course of time. And so, Father, may we live boldly and courageously and let you use us individually and us as a community however you wish. We love you, and we thank you in the name of Jesus. Amen. Hey, before you go, real quick, I just know some of you, man, if that's where you're at kind of with Jesus and you've been kind of battling this intellectual worst case scenario for a long time, and man, you just need to take a step. You need to say, man, I need to talk to somebody. I want to take that step. I want to trust in Jesus. I want to surrender my life. Maybe it's I want to get baptized. I've come up with all these reasons of why I shouldn't, and I don't know enough yet. I hear that from people all the time. Well, I thought about being baptized, but I just don't know enough yet. Listen, you're never going to know enough yet. There comes a point when you just say, God, I surrender. And I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to take you up on your invitation. And so if that's where you're at, and I'd love to talk with you, you can come see me. Some of the other people that are up here would love to help you. Contact us this week whenever you want. However we can help you, we'd love to do so. Take care. We'll look forward to seeing you next Sunday.